WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Occasionally on Fresh Air, we invite people on whose work you regularly hear on NPR and ask them to share some behind-the-scenes stories. We're devoting a couple of programs to that this week. Nina Totenberg is NPR's legal correspondent. Two stories helped make her a household name. She broke the story that Supreme Court nominee Douglas Ginsburg had smoked marijuana. That revelation effectively killed his nomination. And she broke the Anita Hill story. Let's start with an excerpt of Totenberg's report, which included the very first press interview in which Anita Hill accused Clarence Thomas of sexual harassment. This report was filed October 6, 1991, on All Things Considered.
This morning, NPR reported that Anita Hill, a tenured law professor at the University of Oklahoma, told the Senate Judiciary Committee and later the FBI that she'd been sexually harassed by Clarence Thomas when she worked as his personal assistant in the early 1980s. She said that when she worked for Thomas at the Education Department and later the EEOC, he constantly pressured her to go out with him socially, and that he would call her into his office to discuss work and turn the discussion to his, quote, sexual interests. According to Hill's sworn affidavit, a copy of which was obtained by NPR, Thomas, quote, spoke about acts that he'd seen in pornographic films involving such things as women having sex with animals and films involving group sex or rape scenes. He talked about pornographic materials depicting individuals with large penises and breasts, close quote. Hill said that despite her attempts to forestall this behavior, it continued. She said she told only one person about what was happening to her, a friend from law school. The friend, now a state judge in the West, corroborated Hill's story in part, both in an interview with the FBI and with NPR. She said that Hill had told her at the time of the alleged harassment in general, though not in detail. Hill, in an interview with NPR, said she had initially intended to keep quiet about her experiences, fearing retaliation and not wanting to relive the experience. But in early September, she changed her mind.
Here is a person who is in charge of protecting rights of women and other groups in the workplace. And he is using his position of power for personal gain, for one thing. And he did it in a very just ugly and intimidating way. But he's also really in spirit, and I believe in action too, violating the laws that he's there to enforce.
Now, you didn't go with the story as soon as you got Anita Hill's affidavit. I think you went with the story about 5 days later. What did you feel you needed in addition to the affidavit before actually filing the report?
Well, when you're dealing with very serious charges, at least in my view, when you're dealing with very serious charges about a nominee for high office, I am much more comfortable finding out that there is at least some basis for believing those charges to be true. That doesn't mean you know they're true. It means that there is credible evidence to support those charges. Now, an individual named Anita Hill had made this allegation but had not come forward. And I talked to her for many days about whether she would give me an interview about these charges. And it seemed to me that if I was going to air this story, I needed a witness for the prosecution, as it were, and that if the witness was not willing to stand by her charges, the charges were not worthy of airing. And so a good deal of what I did went to both persuading Anita Hill to at least consider coming forward, to verifying some of the charges as much as one humanly could, and in pursuit of that, I found one of her so-called corroborative witnesses, that is, a woman who said she told her about these allegations at the time that the alleged harassment occurred. And I spent a lot of time checking out Anita Hill herself to make sure she wasn't a kook or a crook and didn't have a well-known vendetta against Clarence Thomas. People who have vendettas sometimes say true things, but at least when you are going to put forward their charges, you better say that that person has a longtime vendetta. In Anita Hill's case, I found no history of a vendetta. She was a well-regarded, highly regarded professional. I spoke to most of her employers who spoke highly of her. And so I at least assured myself about her general character, her general reliability. And eventually, when she realized that I had the affidavit, she finally agreed to an interview.
Now, a reporter from Newsday, Timothy Phelps, published the accusations of sexual harassment the night before you went with the story. He didn't have an interview with Anita Hill, and he didn't have the affidavit. But how did you feel about another reporter going with the sexual harassment charges right before you did?
Well, first of all, it was in the Sunday paper. It wasn't really the night before. It was written the night before, as my story was written the night before. And
right.
I certainly could have put a short version of our story on the air because I already had the interview with Anita Hill in the can, as we say. And we gave some consideration to doing that, to putting it in our hourly newscast. But it was really our feeling that this was such a serious story and that we had so much more in detail than he did. And in fact, Newsday initially put his story on the inside of the paper because what he had was the fact that she had made a charge of sexual harassment, but no details. And it was our judgment, and I have to tell you in all candor, if I had to do it over again, I might do it differently, but it was our judgment at the time that we had just so much more of a story and that it was such a serious story that it needed the details to go with it, and that what we were waiting for was I had been unable to find Senator Biden, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee. We'd originally planned to do our story on Saturday night on All Things Considered, which would have been many hours before the Newsday story was even written. But we decided to wait one more news cycle because we couldn't find Senator Biden, and there were very serious charges in this story by her, and in fact by Senator Simon in some ways, about Biden not acting aggressively about these charges and letting them lie dormant for a matter of many weeks. So I felt that we couldn't air the story, and my boss agreed with me until we at least gave it one more news cycle's worth of time to try to find Biden.
But you said in retrospect you might have done things differently. What might you have done differently?
Well, we could have done a very short news spot, 60 seconds long, saying that there were these allegations and running a shortcut of Anita Hill. And we could have done that without ever mentioning Biden, mm-hmm. I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would have, in the traditional news sense of the word, not had to share credit with anybody because we had so much more. But you know, you make those decisions and then you just live with them.
Nina Totenberg is my guest. Now, you were ordered to bring your notes and tapes to the Senate for a special investigation of who leaked the affidavit. You faced contempt of Congress charges and jail for not revealing your source. What did you think were the big issues at stake in your refusing to divulge your source?
Well, it seemed to me obvious that there was no crime that had occurred here. The worst that had occurred was that the United States Senate had been enormously embarrassed by its failure to investigate serious allegations of wrongdoing against a nominee for the United States Supreme Court. And that the minute we talk about embarrassment, putting a reporter in jail because she got information that embarrassed a political body, we're talking about the very core of what we are as a democracy. That we wouldn't tolerate that in the Russians, much less in ourselves. And I like to think that we have a higher standard than the Russians do at this time in the formation of their infant democracy.
When you cover the Supreme Court now and you run into Clarence Thomas, what is the vibe like between the two of you?
Well, first of all, I don't run into him
very much. Right.
I see him on the bench. He sits just above where I sit in the Supreme Court. Now that there's a new member of the court, his seat is no longer on the opposite side of the courtroom. It is right next to the press section, just, sitting above us, a position that I must say makes him look extremely uncomfortable at times. But I've only talked to him once since his confirmation hearings, and that was the press by tradition gives a party for every new justice. And we did that for Justice Thomas as well, and he came, and he was very nice and very social, and when he walked in the door, I was the second person standing there, and we shook hands, and we chatted amicably, and you would not have known that I had done anything to make his life very miserable.
Do you feel that you know who is telling the truth, Clarence Thomas or Anita Hill?
I don't know for sure at all. I mean, I don't think anybody can know for sure. You may think you know, but you can't be 100% sure.
Have you tried to give your opinion even though you're not 100% sure, or do you think
No.
that that's inappropriate?
I think that's inappropriate.
Why?
Because this was a story that happened because, to some extent, because of my coverage. And I sought to cover it as fairly as I knew how. And I would not want to, in the aftermath, go around proselytizing for either side. And that's what we're talking about, because mm-hmm. we're talking about sides here.
I think because you're so well known for investigating Supreme Court nominees, several people, I think, have tried to investigate you and mm-hmm. have even floated rumors about your personal life. And I wonder if that's had any impact on your feelings about investigating others as a reporter and how you handle those investigations and revelations.
Well, it's probably always a good experience for a reporter to be written about occasionally, to know how unfair it can seem and how what little control the subject of the article has. So it's not a bad experience, although you may not like the end product or you may think you're treated unfairly. And sometimes you are.
Sometimes you are treated unfairly?
Sometimes you are treated unfairly. I mean, I don't think I treat people unfairly, but Clarence Thomas probably thinks I treated him unfairly. Maybe Anita Hill thinks I treated her unfairly.
Do you worry about that a lot, what they think?
It concerns me from time to time. To say that I worry about it a lot is not true. But I think it's something that we ought to be concerned about. We ought to try our best to be fair, to give everybody an even shake.
Now, Nina, I can't remember if this was you or not, though I think it was. I remember once listening to All Things Considered and hearing, I believe it was you, say, in the middle of an intro, I can't read this. That was you, right?
That was me. One of my great moments of non-professionalism.
What happened?
Well, first, the background. When I don't do anchoring of All Things Considered anymore because they now have three hosts, but there were several years where I was the regular Friday host and the regular substitute and was on as a co-host of All Things Considered very regularly, all the time. And they had tried to get me to do this for a while, and I had hesitated because I really don't see very well. And I was afraid that I would screw up on the air reading live. And so finally they persuaded me to try it, and of course it was okay. But I remained nervous about my reading deficiencies. One day, they rushed an introduction for a piece into the studio to me about 10 seconds before we were to go on the air. And Robert Crowe, which was doing his piece live from New York, or it was a live what we call tape roll from New York. And what had happened was that the editor had taken down the introduction on the telephone, typing it. This is pre-computer. And his hands had moved on the keyboard about midway through the introduction, so that as you read down live on the air, you went from real words to gibberish. And I had no idea what this story was about. The editor is standing behind me in the studio, sort of jumping up and down, trying to tell me what these words are, but I can't read it. Now, if I'd been a really seasoned pro at that point, doing All Things Considered, I would have realized that and said, well, we have a technical problem. Why don't we go directly to our story in New York? Here's Robert Crowitch. But I wasn't a seasoned pro, and I was furious at being handed this introduction so late and then having it gibberish. And I figured, I'm not going to take the rap for this. So I said, live on the air, I can't read this. Robert Siegel, who was then the news director, called me to his office afterwards for a little discussion. And he was, I think he was really going to woodshed me until I handed him the intro. And when he saw it, he just started to laugh.
It's one of those great moments of radio where something goes terribly wrong on the air. Were you embarrassed or what?
You know, I was so mad I wasn't embarrassed.
Nina, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Nina Totenberg is NPR's legal correspondent. This is Fresh Air.